Welcome, everyone, to the Deep Dive. This is really the only place you need to be for a comprehensive, essential shortcut to this week's most staggering scientific discoveries. I'm Alex Sagan, and I'm ready to guide you through the latest news.
And I'm Sam Fleming, here to connect the threads of discovery and provide the context that turns facts into insights. This is truly a monumental week. We're covering live science for the week of October 18th, 25. And the sheer scope is, well, it's kind of dizzying.
It really is. We're spanning millennia of human history, molecular biology, deep earth geology, astronomical events, pretty much everything.
Right, from the beginning of time almost.
Absolutely. So our mission today is to move quickly, but with immense detail, extracting the core insights and implications from this massive stack of sources from now. We're going from like the fragile nature of quantum states all the way to the shifting nature of Earth's magnetic field.
Okay, let's dive in. Starting right on the cutting edge seems like the place to be. The frontier of modern science, technology, and health breakthroughs.
Yeah, makes sense. Let's look at computation first. Quantum computing. The big hurdle has always been keeping those quantum bits, the qubits, stable, right?
Exactly. That fragility.
Yeah.
Decoherence, they call it.
Yes.
The slightest disturbance and poof, the quantum state collapses. It's been the major bottleneck.
Because checking for errors and correcting them takes just so much computational power. It slows everything down massively. That overhead has been the killer app, just not in a good way.
Uh-huh. And that's why this announcement about a huge leap in error correction is so critical. Researchers used a new approach. It's called algorithmic fault tolerance, or AFT.
AFT. Okay. And what's different about it? They're not just checking after the fact?
No, that's the key thing. It's not retroactive checks. It's not pausing to run diagnostics. Instead, AFT sort of weaves the error detection right into the quantum algorithm itself. It runs concurrently as part of the calculation.
Oh, okay. Built-in error checking. Mm-hmm. And they modeled this using a neutral atom setup.
That's right. Neutral atom architecture. And the impact is, well, it's pretty revolutionary. Their simulations showed they could cut the time and the computational cost of error correction by up to 100 times.
100 times. That's enormous.
It's an exponential reduction in that bottleneck we talked about.
So, okay, what does that mean in the real world? The example they used was optimizing global shipping routes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Optimizing something that complex takes immense power. If your quantum calculation takes a month to run, well, the real-world conditions, weather, fuel prices, whatever, they've already changed by then. The answer is useless.
Obsolete before you even get it.
Right. But if AFT lets you do that same calculation in, say, less than a day, suddenly it's not just a theoretical exercise. It's a practical. It's useful now. That's the promise here.
And you mentioned neutral atom systems. Why do they work particularly well with this AFT approach?
It comes down to flexibility. Neutral atom systems allow for what's called all-to-all connectivity. Basically, any qubit, any atom, can interact directly with any other qubit.
Unlike superconducting systems where the wiring is fixed.
Exactly. Those have physical constraints. Mm. Plus, and this is a big plus, these neutral atom systems can run at room temperature. No need for those incredibly complex, expensive cryogenic cooling systems that superconducting quantum computers require.
Okay, so cheaper, more flexible, faster error correction. It really feels like the timeline for practical quantum computing is shrinking fast.
It certainly looks that way. It's a very exciting development.
So from controlling tiny quantum states to managing massive power flow, let's talk energy storage, especially for EVs, electric vehicles.
Yeah, another area seeing huge leaps. The big buzzword is solid-state batteries. We saw Toyota and Sumitomo make a major commitment.
Right. They're aiming for the world's first mass-produced EV with solid-state batteries by, when was it, 2027 or 2028?
That's the target. And the advantages are, well, they're transformative, not just incremental improvements.
How so? What's the main benefit?
Well, first, safety. By getting rid of the liquid electrolyte that's in current lithium-ion batteries, you dramatically cut the fire risk. That's huge.
Okay, safer. What else?
Performance. The solid material allows for much higher energy densities.
And higher energy density means longer range,
mm-hmm.
faster charging, both.
Both, potentially. More energy packed into the same space. That translates directly to longer driving range, which tackles range anxiety. And it could also enable faster charging. Honda's got a really ambitious goal mentioned in the sources.
Oh, yeah. What are they aiming for?
They're targeting 620 miles. That's 1,000 kilometers on a single charge by 2030. Imagine that. That pretty much eliminates range anxiety for almost everyone.
600 miles. Wow. Okay, that's a game changer. But it's not just lithium, right? There's movement on hydrogen, too.
Definitely. Making hydrogen practical as a green power source is another big frontier. Researchers in Tokyo developed a new type of hydrogen battery using magnesium hydride.
Magnesium hydride. And the challenge with hydrogen storage has always been the heat needed to get the hydrogen back out, right?
Precisely. You need high temperatures to release hydrogen stored in solid compounds efficiently. But this new battery operates at a much, much lower temperature, only 194 degrees Fahrenheit.
194 Fahrenheit. How does that compare to older methods?
It's about four times colder. Existing solid-state methods need somewhere between 572 and 752 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, so a massive difference. What does that lower temperature actually enable?
It means way less energy is wasted, just keeping the storage system hot. So hydrogen storage becomes denser, you can store more in the same volume, it lasts longer, and it's just much more efficient for use in the EV. It gets around needing those bulky high-pressure tanks too, makes hydrogen feel a lot closer to being mainstream.
So tech leaps shrinking timelines for quantum, for batteries, for hydrogen. It gives you some hope, doesn't it? Which kind of leads us to another area where time is absolutely critical, measured in survival rates, actually. Early cancer detection.
Yeah, liquid biopsies. Moving from the lab bench to actual clinical use, that's a huge area.
And the goal is simple, but incredibly hard. Yep. Catch cancer earlier, stage two instead of stage four.
Exactly. Because the survival difference is just stark. Stage two, you're looking at maybe an 85% five-year survival rate on average. Stage four, it drops to like 10%. Blood tests offer a way to screen more people more easily.
So the FDA approved the Shield test from Guardant Health for colon cancer screening. How does that one work?
It looks for tiny clues in the blood, specifically fragments of DNA shed by tumors called circulating tumor DNA or C2DNA, and also these little chemical tags in the DNA called methyl groups. Basically, it's searching for the molecular fingerprint of cancer cells or even precancerous growth, adenomas.
Finding the shadow of the tumor, not the tumor itself. But the sources mentioned a trade-off, didn't they? Sensitivity isn't quite as high as a colonoscopy.
That's right. A colonoscopy is still the gold standard, around 95% sensitivity. The Shield test is more like 83%.
So 83%, that sounds like a significant drop. Why is it still considered a win?
It comes down to compliance, actually getting people screened. The estimates are that around 1 in 3 people who should get a colonoscopy just don't. They avoid it. Maybe it's the prep, the procedure itself, the inconvenience.
Yeah, the prep is famously unpleasant.
Right. So if you offer an easy blood test instead, way more people are likely to actually do it. Even if the test is slightly less sensitive on an individual basis, screening more people means you ultimately detect more cancers earlier across the whole population. It's a public health calculation. More compliance leads to fewer deaths overall.
Okay, that makes sense. Pragmatic. And there was also really impressive news for pancreatic cancer detection. That's one of the really deadly ones because it's usually found so late.
Absolutely. Jay Gohl's team developed a test using a combination of things, microRNAs and a protein biomarker called CA19.
Pancreatic cancer. Symptoms are often vague early on, right?
Right. Extremely vague. That's why diagnosis is often delayed until it's spread. But this test, it achieved detection rates between 88 and 93% across both early and late stages. And when they tweaked it slightly for a U.S. group focusing on that CA19 protein, it picked up 97% of early stage cases.
97% early stage. That's incredible.
It really is. The hope is to get this into clinics within maybe 2 to 4 years. It could genuinely save thousands of lives every year if it pans out.
But the success, catching things earlier with blood tests, it brings up another issue, doesn't it? Especially with those multi-cancer detection tests, the MCDs, like Galleri.
It does. The promise of MCDs is huge screen for dozens of cancers with one blood draw. It sounds amazing, but there are real challenges.
Like what? Cost? Accuracy?
Both. First, cost is a factor. Around $950 for a test like Galleri. That's not trivial. Second, false positives. They can happen, and they cause immense stress and anxiety.
Right. If the test says cancer positive but doesn't know where the cancer is, what happens then?
That's the diagnostic odyssey problem. The patient often ends up in this long, stressful process, maybe lasting up to 6 months, involving scans, biopsies, trying to pinpoint the source.
6 months of uncertainty. That sounds awful.
It is, and it consumes a ton of healthcare resources. Plus, there's another layer. For some very, very early microcancers these tests might pick up, we don't actually know for sure if finding them that early really changes the outcome or if we even have effective treatments yet.
So you might be detecting something that wasn't going to cause harm or that you can't really treat effectively yet.
Exactly. Are we selling genuine hope? Or are we potentially just creating anxiety and clogging up the healthcare system with investigations that might not lead to better health? It's a really tough ethical balance to strike.
A very complex calculation. Potential benefit versus real harm from anxiety and overdiagnosis. That feels like a good pivot point, actually. From complex medical tech to, well, the stranger side of biology.
Absolutely. Segment two, deep dive into the human condition.
Yeah.
Biology and health quirks. And we have to start with the classic question, the myth, the legend. Can you actually get high from licking a toad?
The Colorado River toad, right? Or Sonoran Desert toad. Does it work?
Okay, so the science confirms the toad does secrete a powerful psychoactive compound. It's called 5-MeO-DMT. It's known for causing really intense experiences, euphoria, ego dissolution, sometimes called a whiteout, or entering the void.
So the chemical is there, but the licking part.
That's the myth part. Simply licking the toad is apparently ineffective for getting the psychoactive effect. The compounds in the secretion need to be dried, processed, and usually smoked.
Ah, okay. But is licking it just ineffective, or is it actually dangerous?
It's dangerous, critically dangerous. The toad also secretes other toxins, including cardiac glycosides.
Cardiac glycosides,
right.
Those affect the heart, right?
Very strongly. They can cause severe, potentially fatal heart rhythm problems, mm-hmm. cardiac arrhythmias. So licking the toad isn't just pointless for getting high, it's potentially lethal, science says. Definitely do not lick the toad.
Got it. Don't lick the toad. And there's a conservation issue here too, isn't there?
Huge issue. Poachers are hitting these toad populations hard, collecting them to extract and sell the secretions, precisely because of this psychedelic interest. It's putting the species under serious threat.
So it's this weird situation. Scientists are studying synthetic 5-MeO-DMT as a potential fast-acting antidepressant.
Right. It seems to work differently than psilocybin or LSD.
But the demand for the natural stuff is fueling poaching and harming the animal.
It's a real ethical tangle.
Yeah.
Moving from dangerous secretions to strange medical blockages. There was a really bizarre case study about a 63-year-old woman with chronic nausea.
Yeah, what was causing that?
It turned out to be a massive gastric bisor.
Yeah.
Basically, a huge, hardened lump of undigested food material stuck in her stomach, blocking the exit.
A food lump? How does that even happen?
The likely trigger was a medication. She was taking a semaglutide drug, like Ozempic, for type 2 diabetes and obesity.
Ah, those drugs can slow down stomach emptying, right?
Exactly. Delayed gastric emptying is a known side effect. In her case, it seems the food just sat there for so long, it compacted into this solid mass.
Okay, so a giant food blockage. How did they get rid of it? Surgery.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But no. The treatment was surprisingly low tech. They use diet soda.
Diet soda. Seriously.
Yeah. Apparently, the carbonation and the acids, carbonic acid, phosphoric acid, worked together to break down and soften the bisor. They gave her 1.5 liters over 12 hours, and it dissolved the mass. Avoided surgery entirely.
Wow.
And get this, it's actually the preferred first-line treatment for this condition worldwide. Cheap, effective, non-invasive. Sometimes the simple solutions work.
Diet soda dissolving stomach blockages. File that one away. Okay, on a more serious public health note, let's talk pickleball.
It's exploded in popularity.
It really has. Up something like 311% since 2020. Huge growth. But that growth has come with a downside. A big spike in eye injuries.
A really alarming spike. We're talking serious stuff. Black eyes, broken bones around the eye socket, detached retinas, and even globe trauma where the eyeball itself ruptures. That can cause blindness.
Ouch. And the report said most of these injuries are recent.
Yeah, 88% of the reported eye injuries happened just between 2022 and 2024. It directly correlates with the sports boom, yeah. And there's a clear demographic pattern, too.
Who's getting hurt most?
Players age 50 or older accounted for 70% of the injuries.
70%. Why the older demographic, do they think?
It's likely a combination of factors. One, you have a lot of new casual players jumping in who might not be used to the speed of the ball or the close quarters play. Two, older players might have some age-related eye vulnerabilities, maybe pre-existing conditions that make the retina more susceptible to detaching on impact.
And the solution seems obvious, but maybe isn't happening.
Eye protection. Protective eyewear. Medical groups strongly recommend it, but it's not actually required by the sport's governing bodies. So a lot of casual players just don't wear it. It feels like a largely preventable problem.
Yeah, seems like a simple fix could prevent a lot of serious injuries. Okay, shifting gears again, back to chronic conditions. Scientists have now formally recognized a new type of diabetes, type 5.
That's right, type 5 diabetes. And this is important because it's thought to affect a huge number of people, maybe 20 to 25 million globally, mostly in Asia and Africa.
And these people were being misdiagnosed before?
Often, yeah. Misdiagnosed as either type 1 or type 2, which meant they might not have been getting the right treatment, which can be ineffective or even dangerous.
So what makes type 5 different from type 1 or type 2?
Okay, so type 1 is autoimmune. The body attacks its own insulin-producing cells. Type 2 is mainly about insulin resistance, often linked to being overweight. Type 5 is different. It stems from damage to the pancreas, specifically the insulin-producing cells, caused by severe undernutrition, usually early in life.
So the pancreas itself is damaged, leading to insufficient insulin production, not resistance.
Exactly. The machinery is broken. And critically, people with type 5 are typically low body weight, unlike many type 2 patients. But their body's cells still respond well to insulin treatment, unlike type 1, where the cells are destroyed.
So the treatment needs to be managed carefully, especially if they're already malnourished.
Precisely. Giving too much insulin to someone who is undernourished can cause dangerously low blood sugar. Formally recognizing type 5 helps doctors diagnose it correctly and tailor treatment. And importantly, it should attract more research funding focused on these specific populations.
That's a really important distinction. Okay, we talked about DNA fragments from tumors in the blood earlier. Now let's talk about giant DNA structures in the mouth.
Yeah, this is fascinating. They've discovered these huge circular pieces of bacterial DNA in our oral microbiome. They're calling them inicles.
Inicles? Why haven't we seen these before? The mouth is pretty well studied.
Because they're massive and structurally complex. Standard DNA sequencing methods, called short-read sequencing, chop everything into tiny pieces. These inicle structures are just too big and tangled to be put back together properly with that method. It took newer, more expensive long-read sequencing technology to actually see them.
And they're common.
Very common. Found in about 74% of the people they studied. But here's where it gets really interesting. They seem to interact with our immune system.
How so?
And there's a potential link to cancer. The researchers noticed that people with certain types of head and neck cancer, or colorectal cancer, had significantly lower levels of these inicles in their mouths compared to healthy people.
Lower levels in cancer patients. Okay, yeah. That's just a correlation for now, right?
Purely correlational at this stage, yes. But it raises the intriguing possibility that the presence, absence, or amount of these inicles could one day be used as a biomarker, maybe for cancer risk or progression. It adds another layer to that known connection between what's happening in your mouth and your overall systemic health.
Super interesting, the hidden world in our mouths. Okay, one last biological deep dive before we go cosmic.sleep. Specifically, REM sleep and memory.
Yeah, this study looked at what exactly REM sleep does for our memories. And the conclusion wasn't just that it stores them, but that it actively refines and reorganizes them. Think of it like tidying up and generalizing.
So REM sleep makes memories less specific, but maybe more broadly useful.
That seems to be the idea. The research suggests REM sleep weakens the very specific, unique details of a memory, like maybe the exact pattern on a specific dog's coat you saw.
Okay.
While at the same time, it strengthens the broader category, like the general concept of dog or animal. It's trading pinpoint detail for more generalized knowledge.
So it's reshaping how memories are stored. And how does that fit with other sleep stages, like deep sleep?
It seems to be complementary. Deep sleep, or slow wave sleep, seems to be more about preserving memories accurately in their original detailed form.
So deep sleep locks in the details. REM sleep helps you generalize and see the bigger picture.
That looks like the dynamic. A pretty elegant system, really. Slow wave preserves, ROM generalizes and integrates. Helps make memories useful for future situations.
Understanding how the mind processes things, that actually feels like a nice bridge to our next segment. We're going from the internal landscape of the brain to the vast external landscape of space. Let's pivot to segment 3, the expanding universe and astronomical wonders.
All right, let's go big. And where else to start but with the James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, still churning out incredible data. This week, new infrared views of the M87 black hole.
M87, that's the supermassive one in the M87 galaxy, the first one we ever got a direct picture of.
That's the one, famous for shooting out that enormous jet of particles thousands of light years long. JWST imaged that jet in infrared light using its NIRCam instrument.
Why infrared? What does that view add?
Infrared is crucial because it bridges the gap between what we see in radio waves and what we see in visible light. It gives us a more complete picture. This makes M87 kind of the perfect natural laboratory for studying how these powerful jets actually work, how they get launched and focused right near the black hole's edge.
And these new images confirm something important about the jet structure.
Yes, they gave a much clearer view of the counterjet. There's the main bright jet blasting out one way, but there's also a fainter jet shooting out in the opposite direction. Seeing that counterjet clearly, especially close to the galaxy's core, is really important.
Why? What does confirming the counterjet tell us?
It strongly validates our models of how these jets form. The theories involve twisted magnetic fields around the black hole's accretion disk, creating these outflows in both directions. Seeing both jets clearly gives us much higher confidence that those models are on the right track.
Okay, cool. JWST also solved a long-standing puzzle about stars before they explode as supernovae, right? Identifying a specific star.
Yes. SN 2025. It's a massive red supergent star that JWST caught basically right before it went supernova in a nearby galaxy.
And the mystery was, why didn't we see more stars like this just before they blew up? We knew they had to be there.
Exactly. This star, SN 2025, was incredibly bright, 100,000 times brighter than our sun, but it was really hard to see with older telescopes. JWST's infrared view showed why.
Dust.
Tons of dust. The star was shrouded in this thick, heavy shell of dust it had thrown off. This dust cloud blocked most of the visible light, making the star appear over 100 times dimmer than it actually was.
So the theory was right. These massive stars get really dusty right at the end of their lives and essentially hide themselves from visible light telescopes.
Precisely. JWST's infrared capability let it peer through that dust veil and see the star clearly. It confirms that these dusty, doomed giants are out there, exactly where our models predicted they should be. Mystery solved.
Fantastic. Okay, from dying stars, let's jump way, way back in time, almost to the cosmic dark ages, hunting for a really faint radio signal.
Yeah, astronomers are trying to probe one of the most mysterious epochs, the time before the first stars fully illuminated the universe. They're looking for something called the 21-centimeter hydrogen line.
The 21-centimeter line? What is that exactly?
It's a very subtle radio signal that's emitted when the electron and proton in a neutral hydrogen atom flip their relative spins. It's incredibly faint, but it acts like a cosmic thermometer.
A thermometer.
Because the strength and characteristics of that signal tell us about the temperature and density of all that neutral hydrogen gas that filled the early universe. They analyzed almost a decade of data for the Murchison Wide Field Array in Australia.
And what did they find? Or maybe what did they not find?
They didn't find the specific signature they were looking for that would have indicated the universe started out really cold during that reionization period. The absence of that signal is actually the key finding.
Meaning?
It strongly suggests the universe started heating up much earlier than some models predicted, maybe around 800 million years after the Big Bang, even before starlight became widespread.
What would have heated up so early?
The most likely culprits are high-energy X-rays. X-rays coming from the accretion disks around the very first black holes as they formed, and also from the very first generation of stars, which were thought to be incredibly massive, hot, and short-lived. This early heating was probably crucial for eventually ionizing all that neutral gas and making the universe transparent, like it is today.
Wow, X-rays from the first black holes heating the universe. Okay. And speaking of first generations, there was another amazing discovery, the most pristine star ever found.
Yes, SDSS J0715-7334. It's a red giant star, and the key thing is its composition. It has the lowest concentration of heavy elements, what astronomers call metallicity, ever seen, by a significant margin.
Metallicity? That's anything heavier than hydrogen and helium, right?
Correct. So this star is made almost entirely of just hydrogen and helium, the stuff forged in the Big Bang. This makes it almost certainly a direct descendant of the universe's very first stars, a second-generation star, basically.
But it's also described as a rule breaker, because it shouldn't have been able to form with so few metals.
That's the puzzle. There's this concept called the fine structure cooling threshold. Basically, for a giant cloud of gas to collapse and form a star, it needs to cool down. Heavy elements, metals, are really efficient coolants because their complex atoms can radiate heat away easily.
So if you don't have enough metals, the gas cloud stays too hot to collapse.
That's the standard thinking. This star has less metal than that supposed threshold. So how did it form?
What's the leading idea?
Cosmic dust. The thinking is that even tiny amounts of dust, perhaps created and ejected by even earlier first-generation massive stars, could provide just enough extra cooling surface area to allow these extremely low metallicity gas clouds to collapse after all.
Mm.
It means we might need to tweak our models of exactly how the first stars formed.
Okay, from the almost invisible composition of stars to literally invisible matter, astronomers spotted the smallest dark object ever found using gravitational lensing.
Yeah, this is cool. They detected an object estimated to be about a million times the mass of the sun, which sounds huge, but in cosmic terms, especially for dark matter structures, it's quite small.
And they found it how? By how it bent light.
Exactly, using gravitational lensing. They were looking at a distant galaxy whose light was being warped into a circle called an Einstein ring by the gravity of something massive in the foreground. This small dark object created a subtle extra distortion in that ring.
Like finding a tiny flaw in the funhouse mirror's reflection, the Einstein ring was B1938 plus 666, about 10 billion light years away.
That's the one. And this million solar mass object is about 100 times smaller than the previous record holder for the smallest thing found this way.
So what do they think this small dark object is?
The most likely candidate is a small, compact clump of dark matter.
And why is finding a small clump significant?
Because it supports the leading theory of dark matter, called cold dark matter, or CDM. CDM predicts that dark matter should be able to clump together on relatively small scales like this. If dark matter were hot or warm, meaning faster moving particles, it would tend to smooth out such small structures. So finding these small clumps is evidence for cold dark matter. Gravitational lensing is one of the few ways we can indirectly probe these invisible structures.
Incredible. Okay, let's bring it back home, closer to our solar system. Still searching for hidden planets out there. Forget Planet 9 for a second, now there's Planet Y.
Yeah, the plot thickens in the outer solar system. The hunt for Planet 9, or Planet X, that hypothetical big Neptune-sized world way out there, is ongoing. But this new study suggests the gravitational weirdness we see in the Kuiper Belt might be caused by something different.
Planet Y, smaller and closer.
That's the idea. Mm-hmm. Hypothesized to be maybe Earth-sized and located much closer in than Planet 9 was thought to be, maybe 100 to 200 times the Earth-Sun distance, instead of hundreds of times further out.
And the evidence for this Planet Y comes from?
A specific pattern. They looked at about 50 Kuiper Belt objects, KDOs, and found their orbital planes are tilted by about 15 degrees relative to the plane of the solar system, in a way that's hard to explain otherwise. This tilt could potentially be caused by the gravity of a closer, Earth-sized planet.
Still just a theory at this point, though.
Oh, absolutely. It's circumstantial evidence. But the researchers are hopeful. The Vera C. Rubin Observatory is just coming online. It's designed for massive sky surveys. They think it has a really good shot at either finding Planet Y or Planet X, or definitively ruling them out within the next, say, 2 or 3 years.
Exciting times for planet hunters. Okay, meanwhile, that weird metallic asteroid Psyche, the one supposedly worth $100,000 quadrillion, any closer to figuring out how it got its metal coat?
There's a new theory gaining traction, ferrovolcanism.
Ferrovolcanism, like iron volcanoes.
Pretty much. Volcanoes spewing molten iron and nickel instead of the silicate rock magma we're used to on Earth. The idea is that Psyche might be the exposed core of an early protoplanet that got stripped of its rocky mantle. This ferrovolcanism could explain how that metallic core developed its surface features.
But how do you get iron magma erupting? Wouldn't it be too dense?
That's the catch. This theory really only works if Psyche's overall composition is similar to a specific type of rare meteorite called a mesosiderite. These meteorites have a mix of rock and metal, but crucially, a relatively low overall iron content.
Why low iron?
If it had too much iron, the core would be too dense, too compacted. It wouldn't build up enough internal pressure to actually force molten metal up through cracks to the surface. So the ferrovolcanism idea requires this specific, slightly less iron-rich chemistry for the original body. It tells us something about how these early planetary bodies differentiated.
Fascinating. Okay, let's hop over to the moon. Big news for the Artemis program, related to the moon's biggest crater.
Yeah, the South Pole Aitken Basin, the SPA. Huge ancient impact crater at the lunar South Pole. For a long time, everyone assumed it was formed by an object hitting from the south.
But new analysis says...
Nope.
No.
New data suggests the impact actually came from the north. And this has a really important implication for where certain valuable materials ended up.
What kind of materials?
Something called CREEP. Stands for potassium, K, rare earth elements, REE, and phosphorus, P. It's this specific type of lunar material that's really important for understanding the moon's formation and volcanic history.
Okay, so if the impact came from the north, where did the creep get thrown?
towards the south. It would have been ejected and piled up mostly around the southern rim of the giant SPA basin.
And that's good news for Artemis III because...
Because Artemis III is planned to land astronauts right there in the lunar South Pole region. This new impact model suggests those crucial creep samples should be sitting right where the astronauts are scheduled to land, making them much easier to find and collect. It's a lucky break for the mission scientists.
Perfect timing. Okay, just quickly, the idea of planetary age is complicated, isn't it?
It really is. You've got different theories about how planets form in the first place, accretion versus streaming instability. And then you've got different ways to define age. Is it when the bulk of the planet first came together? Or is it the age of its surface, which we usually estimate by counting craters?
And Earth throws a wrench in the works there.
Big time. Because of plate tectonics, volcanism, erosion, Earth's surface is constantly being renewed. So based on surface age from crater counting, Earth looks incredibly young compared to, say, Mars or Mercury, even though they all formed around the same time. Earth basically keeps paving over its own history.
Right. Makes sense. Okay, before we leave space, for anyone looking up this weekend, what should they look out for?
Definitely the Orionids meteor shower. That's debris left behind by Halley's Comet. It peaks around October 20th and 21st. And bonus, it coincides with two comets being near their peak brightness, Comet Lemon and Comet Swan.
Three celestial shows for the price of one. Any tips for people who want to try and photograph the comets?
Absolutely. Comets can be tricky. You'll want a camera that can do long exposures, ideally with a wide aperture lens, something like f2.8 or faster if possible, to gather lots of light. A wide focal length helps frame them against the starry background.
And stability is key, right? Tripod.
Essential. Yeah. Absolutely essential. Use a sturdy tripod. For exposure time, there's the 500 rule as a starting point. Divide 500 by your lens's focal length to get the maximum shutter speed in seconds before stars start trailing. You'll probably need to experiment. And definitely use an astronomy app like Stellarium to know exactly where to point your camera, because comets move against the background stars night by night.
Great tips. Okay, from the quiet beauty of the cosmos, let's come crashing back down to Earth. Yeah. Segment 4, planetary crisis and geological shifts and the climate news. It's pretty stark this week.
It really is. That World Meteorological Organization, the WMO report, had some deeply troubling numbers. The headline figure was the atmospheric CO2 concentration. It jumped by a record 3.5 parts per million, PPM, in 2024 alone.
3.5 PPM in 1 year. That's the biggest single-year jump ever recorded, isn't it? Since measurements began back in the 50s.
That's right. The total concentration is now up to 423.9 ppm. We're just locking in more and more future warming. And it wasn't just CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide also hit record highs.
What's driving this record spike? Just fossil fuels?
Fossil fuels are the main driver, absolutely. But the report also highlighted a surge in global wildfires releasing carbon, and crucially, signs that our natural carbon sinks. The oceans and forests that normally absorb a chunk of our emissions are becoming less effective. They're struggling to keep up.
Which leads to that really scary idea of a positive feedback loop, right? Warming weakens the sinks, which leads to more warming.
Exactly. As the planet warms, the ability of these natural systems to soak up CO2 goes down, which just accelerates the warming further. It's a major concern.
And that concern seems amplified by a new discovery down in Antarctica, multiplying methane seeps.
Yeah, this is potentially huge. Scientists found dozens of new active methane seeps on the seafloor in the Ross Sea. Remember, methane is way more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas, especially in the short term, like 80 times more potent over 20 years.
And these seeps are new in an area they've studied before.
That's the alarming part. It's an area that's been surveyed for decades, and suddenly there are all these new seeps bubbling up, changing the local ecosystem.
So the fear is, this is a new feedback loop kicking in, melting ice releasing trapped methane.
That's the terrifying possibility. There are vast amounts of methane locked away in those Antarctic seafloor sediments, potentially as methane hydrates. Mm. If warming waters are causing these hydrates to destabilize and release methane gas, and if that gas makes it up through the water column into the atmosphere, well, that could trigger a rapid acceleration of global warming that isn't currently factored into most climate models. It's an urgent research priority now.
Wow. Okay. So that's a potential rapid warming feedback. But then there is another study looking at a much slower geological climate control, Earth's hidden thermostat.
Yeah, this was fascinating. A geological study suggesting Earth might have a way to overcorrect for climate change, but on very long timescales. It involves the phosphorus cycle.
The phosphorus cycle. How does that regulate climate? And faster than things like rock weathering?
Apparently, yes. Faster than silicate weathering, which works over hundreds of thousands to millions of years. This supercharged phosphor cycle operates more on a 100,000-year timescale.
Okay, walk me through it. How does it work?
It starts with warmer oceans. Warmer water triggers massive blooms of phytoplankton, tiny marine plants. These phytoplankton gobble up phosphorus and, crucially, suck huge amounts of CO2 out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis.
Okay, phytoplankton bloom, absorb CO2, then what?
When they die, they sink to the ocean floor, taking all that carbon with them. It gets buried in sediments, effectively removing it from the atmosphere for long periods. That's the carbon sequestration part.
Right, but what makes it a supercharged cycle?
The feedback loop. In warmer oceans, which often have lower oxygen levels near the seabed, the phosphorus that got buried with the dead phytoplankton gets released back into the water much more quickly and efficiently.
Ah, so more phosphorus becomes available.
Which fuels even more phytoplankton growth, which draws down even more CO2. It's a powerful negative feedback warming triggers a response that leads to cooling.
So the implication is this mechanism might be strong enough to counteract even massive human emissions over the long haul, like ensuring the next ice age still happens on schedule.
That's the potential long-term implication, yes. Over a 100,000-year time frame, this could theoretically pull enough CO2 out to counteract our current pulse of emissions and keep the planet's natural ice age cycles roughly on track.
But this does absolutely nothing for us now, right? In terms of the warming we're causing over decades and centuries.
Absolutely nothing. That's the critical caveat. This is a geological process working on geological time. It offers zero protection against the immediate impacts of climate change, the sea level rise, extreme weather, ecosystem collapse that we're facing in our lifetimes, and those of the next few generations. It's a safety net for the planet's deep future, perhaps, but not for human civilization's near-term survival.
Right, an important distinction. Okay, the Earth isn't just changing climatically. The ground beneath our feet is active, too. Signs of unrest at a volcano in Iran, one thought to be extinct.
Yeah, Taftan volcano. It hasn't erupted in maybe 700,000 years, so it was considered extinct. But recent satellite data picked up ground uplift.
The ground is swelling. How much?
About 3.5 inches over a 10-month period near the summit. That kind of bulging strongly suggests something is happening underneath either magma moving or gas pressure building up.
So, not extinct anymore.
They've reclassified it as dormant, not extinct. It means it needs to be monitored much more closely now. There's no sign of an imminent eruption, but it's definitely woken up in some sense.
Okay. And speaking of volcanic unrest, AI has been used to analyze the Campi Flegrei volcano near Naples in Italy. What did that find?
This was pretty amazing. The AI went through seismic data from 2022 to 2025 and identified over 54,000 tiny earthquakes that traditional methods had missed. The old methods only found about 12,000.
Wow, so the AI found more than four times as many quakes. What did that extra data reveal?
It allowed them to map the structure underneath the area with incredible clarity. They found a massive, very distinct ring fault directly beneath the town of Pozzuoli, which sits right in the middle of this volcanic caldera.
A ring fault. And the ground there is rising too, isn't it?
It is. Rising about 4 inches a year right now. That combination, a clear fault structure plus ongoing uplift, suggests there's a real potential for a significant earthquake, maybe up to magnitude 5, localized right there as the crust breaks under the strain. It doesn't necessarily mean a volcanic eruption is more likely, but the earthquake risk itself is serious in such a densely populated area.
Crucial information for hazard planning. Okay, staying with earthquakes. There's new evidence suggesting a scary link between the Cascadia Fault Zone off the Pacific Northwest coast and the San Andreas Fault in California.
Yeah, this idea has been around, but there's new geological evidence supporting it. It comes from studying turbidites.
Turbidites. Those are underwater landslide deposits, right? Triggered by earthquakes.
Exactly. When a huge quake hits offshore, it triggers massive flows of sediment down submarine canyons. These flows settle on the deep ocean floor, leaving distinct layers. These layers act like a geological record of past earthquakes.
So what did the turbidites show?
They found evidence in sediment cores suggesting that sometimes, very shortly after a massive Cascadia earthquake up north, another massive earthquake was triggered down south on the San Andreas Fault, maybe within hours or days.
Hours or days? How could they tell the timing was that close from sediment layers?
It's complex, but it involves looking at how the sediment layers are structured. In one key core sample taken years ago, they found evidence that one turbidite layer, presumably from Cascadia, was still settling when another layer, presumably from San Andreas, flowed over the top of it. That implies a very short time gap between the two triggering events.
Wow. So if a major Canscalia quake happens, it could immediately trigger a San Andreas quake. What are the implications of that?
The implications for emergency response are massive and, frankly, terrifying. Planners usually think of these as separate potential disasters. But if one can trigger the other almost immediately, you'd have catastrophic damage occurring simultaneously across the entire U.S. West Coast, from Washington State down to Southern California. Coordinating rescue and relief efforts under those conditions would be an unprecedented nightmare. Resources would be stretched impossibly thin.
That's a sobering thought. Okay, one last geological item, the Earth's magnetic field. That weak spot over the South Atlantic is getting weaker.
Yes, the South Atlantic Anomaly, or SAA. Satellite data confirms it's continued to grow and deepen since around 2014. It's also expanding, particularly westward towards Africa, and it looks like it might even be splitting or developing a second lobe of weakness.
And this SAA is a weak spot because...
Because of what's happening deep in the Earth's liquid outer core. There are areas down there where the magnetic field lines are actually reversed. They loop back into the core instead of radiating outwards. These reverse flux patches are what cause the weakened field strength at the surface above them.
And the main concern with this growing weak spot is for satellites.
Primarily, yes. Satellites passing through the SAA in low Earth orbit get bombarded with much higher levels of energetic solar particles and cosmic rays because the magnetic shield is weaker there. This increases the risk of electronic malfunctions, data corruption, and long-term damage to the satellites. Scientists are watching closely to see if this continued weakening is a precursor to a larger shift, maybe even a full reversal of the magnetic poles, though that's likely a very slow process if it happens.
Okay, from planetary systems crashing and shifting, let's turn to the traces left by humans across time. Segment 5, human history and cultural footprints. Where do we start? Ancient Egypt.
Let's. A really significant discovery in the Sinai Desert. A 3,500-year-old Egyptian military fortress at a site called Tel El Karuba.
3,500 years old. Was it well preserved?
Incredibly well preserved for its age. It covered about 2 acres, part of that strategic Way of Horus road network connecting Egypt to the Levant. They found walls, towers, storage silos, even ovens with fossilized dough still inside, like the bakers were interrupted mid-task.
Fossilized dough. Amazing. Do they know who built it? Which pharaoh?
Based on pottery styles and jar seals stamped with his royal name, the archaeologists believe it was likely built during the reign of Pharaoh Thutmose I, around 1500 BC.
And why is pinning it to Thutmose significant?
Because it provides concrete evidence supporting the idea that he was a key figure in really establishing and organizing Egypt's imperial defense system in that region. This fortress network allowed Egypt to control trade routes and project power into Canaan and Syria for centuries during the New Kingdom. It shows sophisticated, long-term strategic planning early in the empire's peak.
Okay, let's jump forward in time and across the Mediterranean. A mass grave found in Croatia from Roman times.
Yes, at the site of the ancient Roman city of Mursa. They found a well filled with skeletons.
A well used as a burial pit? What was going on?
It seems to be linked to a specific, incredibly bloody battle. The Battle of Mursa, fought in AD 260. This was during the crisis of the 3rd century, a really chaotic period for Rome with civil wars, plague, and invasions. The skeletons are likely the remains of soldiers killed in that battle.
How can they tell? Were there signs of violence?
Yes. Many of the skeletons, mostly young to middle-aged men, showed evidence of blunt force trauma, weapon injuries, consistent with battle casualties. And importantly, the bodies seem to have been stripped of valuables and just dumped unceremoniously into the well, suggesting a breakdown of normal burial practices during a chaotic time.
And genetics told a story, too, about diversity.
It did. Genetic analysis showed a high degree of diversity among the individuals in the well. This fits perfectly with what we know about the Roman army at that time. During the crisis, the legions were increasingly reliant on recruiting soldiers and mercenaries from all over the empire and beyond, Gauls, Germans, Sarmatians, people from the eastern provinces to fill the ranks. The grave reflects that multicultural, strained military reality.
Fascinating. Okay, moving even further east to Neolithic China, a discovery described as macabre, skeleton masks and skull cups.
Yeah, this was from the Liangzu culture about 5,000 years ago. Archaeologists found artifacts made from human bones, specifically skull fragments fashioned into masks or cups.
Made from human skulls. Was this some kind of ancestor worship or ritual?
That's what you might initially think, but the context suggests otherwise. These bone artifacts weren't found in careful burials. They were found discarded in canals and ditches, along with everyday trash like broken pottery and animal bones. The human bones themselves showed signs of being deliberately worked, cut, polished, drilled, and then just thrown away.
Discarded like rubbish. That implies a lack of reverence, doesn't it?
It really does. The interpretation is that this practice might reflect a shift in how the dead were perceived, possibly linked to rapid urbanization happening in the Liangzhu culture at the time. As communities grew larger and less kin-based, perhaps the bodies of some individuals came to be seen less as ancestors and more as raw material. It's a strange, unsettling practice that seems to have emerged quickly, lasted maybe 200 years, and then vanished just as quickly.
A very different attitude towards human remains. Speaking of remains and attitudes, back to Rome. The miniature bronze skeleton, a party favor.
Yes, the larva convivalis, which translates roughly as banquet ghost. It's a tiny, articulated bronze skeleton, maybe just a few inches high.
And people brought these to parties. Why?
As memento mori, a reminder of death. But in a surprisingly cheerful Roman way, it tied into Epicurean philosophy. Life is short, death is inevitable, so enjoy the pleasures of life like a good banquet while you can. There are ancient writings describing hosts tossing similar little skeletons, maybe made of silver, onto the dinner table and saying something like, "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die."
A morbidly cheerful party favor. Only the Romans.
Okay, let's reflect on a more modern figure whose work profoundly changed our view of the living world, Jane Goodall.
Her legacy is just immense, isn't it? But complex, too. Her contributions were revolutionary at the time.
Like what specifically? What did she change? Well, just the idea of long-term patient observation of animals in the wild was groundbreaking. Then, recognizing chimpanzees as individuals with distinct personalities, discovering their tool use, documenting their complex social lives, including cooperation and even warfare. All of this flew in the face of the prevailing scientific view back then, which tended to see animals as simplistic, instinct-driven machines. She forced science to confront the richness of animal minds.
Right. She really challenged the idea of human uniqueness in many ways. But the sources also mentioned some unintended consequences of her early methods.
They did. Looking back with modern ethical standards, some early practices raised concerns. For instance, her initial system of provisioning the chimps at Gombe with bananas while it helped habituate them almost certainly increased levels of aggression and competition within that group, potentially skewing their natural behavior.
The banana feeding stations.
Exactly. And also because Gombe was studied so intensely and for so long, some behaviors observed there, like a perceived lack of strong female social bonds compared to males, were mistakenly assumed to be typical for all chimpanzees everywhere for a long time. Later research in other locations showed much more variability.
So focusing too much on one group led to overgeneralization.
It seems so. Modern primatology has evolved significantly, of course. Today, researchers emphasize distance, using masks to prevent disease transmission, using local language names, not giving provisions, and importantly, using non-invasive techniques like genetic analysis from dung samples to understand community structure, paternity, and relatedness without direct interference. Her pioneering work paved the way, but the methods continue to improve.
A constantly evolving field. Okay, a couple of quick, slightly lighter notes before we wrap up history. That viral Chicago rat hole, turns out it probably wasn't a rat.
Yeah, the internet-famous sidewalk imprint. Forensic analysis by scientists at the Field Museum concluded there's a 98.7% likelihood it was actually made by a squirrel, most likely an eastern gray or a fox squirrel, based on the shape, size, and claw marks.
So the Windy City sidewalk squirrel doesn't have quite the same ring to it, does it?
Not quite. Rebranding might be required.
And sticking with wildlife, the Wildlife Photographer of the Year Award, a haunting image.
Yes, a really striking photo called Ghost Town Visitor. It shows a rare brown hyena walking through the ruins of an abandoned diamond mining town in Namibia at night. It's eerie, beautiful, and highlights that concept of urban wildlife, even in a place humans have deserted. A really powerful image.
Okay, one final historical thought exercise. What if Columbus hadn't reached the Americas in 1492?
The historical consensus is pretty strong on this one. It wouldn't have prevented European arrival for long, just delayed it slightly.
Why? Someone else would have made it soon after.
Almost certainly. The oceanography was favorable. The prevailing wind and current systems basically funnel ships from the Canary Islands westward across the Atlantic. Given the maritime ambitions of Spain and Portugal at the time, and the navigational knowledge they possessed, another explorer, likely Spanish or Portuguese, would probably have made a similar landfall within a few years, maybe a decade at most.
But the details might have changed significantly. Who got there first mattered.
Absolutely. If, say, a Portuguese expedition had succeeded first, it might have completely altered the political landscape. Maybe the 1494 Treaty of Tordesillas, which divided the New World between Spain and Portugal along an arbitrary line, would never have happened or would have been drawn differently.
Meaning Portuguese might have become the dominant language in many parts of the Americas instead of Spanish.
It's possible. And a fun little hypothetical. If Columbus hadn't led the first successful voyage, the U.S. capital might not be in the District of Columbia. It could have ended up being called something like Pinzonia, named after the Pinzon brothers, who were experienced captains commanding two of the three ships on Columbus's first voyage and were arguably crucial to its success. History hinges on such fine points sometimes.
Pinzonia, USA. Definitely different. Okay, what an incredible range we've covered this week.
It really has been a journey. From the deep secrets inside our own mounds with those inoculate structures and the ethics of early cancer screening, through the incredibly delicate dance of quantum computing, all the way out to imaging black hole jets and finding stars from the dawn of time, and then back down to Earth's churning geology and shifting climate.
Right.
It's just staggering.
The constant state of flux, isn't it? Both in the universe and right here on our planet, and in our understanding of it all.
Absolutely. We saw that star, SDSS J07157334, that basically broke the rules we thought governed star formation from pristine gas. And we saw that tiny clump of dark matter found through lensing that seems to perfectly fit our current best theory, cold dark matter. Science constantly refines, confirms, and sometimes completely overturns our assumptions.
Which leads perfectly to a final thought for our listeners.
Indeed. Considering discoveries like that pristine, rule-breaking star and the new limits being placed on that faint radio whisper from the universe's dark ages, it makes you wonder, what fundamental assumption do we hold today about the cosmos? Maybe about the very nature or distribution of that dark matter we just talked about, the stuff seemingly confirmed by that Einstein ring data. What fundamental assumption will be completely overturned, shown to be wrong or incomplete, by the data gathered just 3 years from now by powerhouse new observatories like the Vera C. Rubin? What cornerstone of cosmology today is tomorrow's historical footnote?
A brilliant question to ponder. What current truth is about to be shattered? Thank you for joining us for this week's deep dive. We'll see you next time.